Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the last of our series of research seminars for this academic year. I'm Spiros Poulomides, I'm the director of the Lenin Observatory, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you all here this evening for our very special guest, Stathis Kalivas. I don't think I really need to introduce Stathis extensively. He deserves it because he is, I think, the foremost political scientist, Greek political scientist of his generation, and he's a great credit to the profession and to his country, of course. So I really don't want to say as much as I should say about him because most of you know him and his work. You all know that he's the Arnold Wolfers Professor of Political Science at the University of Yale. He's a longtime friend of the Observatory. I remember actually chairing a lecture given by Stathis in 1994 in the Graham Wallace Room in the old building. And he's been coming back to visit us repeatedly ever since. And it's a great pleasure to invite him and welcome him to speak today about a title, a topic which has slightly changed the title since we advertised it on the website. The punctuated equilibrium has gone from the title. Now we're left with how did modern Greece develop? And I think it may be a slightly longer talk now as a result. But please assist me in welcoming Stathis to this evening.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and a great honor. I always like to return here. In fact, some of the ideas that led to the book on which this talk is based as an extension, I think I first presented it here about 4 years ago. So since time is short, I should be, let's see. We tried it and it worked. So, yes. So, what I'm going to talk today about is an attempt to make sense not just of why Greece is where it is today, but how it came to be throughout its modern trajectory. So, I'll discuss the motivation first, then discuss the standard story of Greece's political and economic development. I'll critique it, present an alternative, and then conclude with some implications and some questions about it. So the motivation is obvious. It's the crisis, and that's why I became more interested in trying to understand how the country came to where it is today. And usually that gives an opportunity for people to explore the past in order to make sense of the present, but I actually became interested in the flip side as well, to try to understand also the past under a new light. Taking advantage of the situation, of the present situation. So, what are the theories that people have put forward to try to understand Greece's present predicament, but also in light of its trajectory? Bad institutions, and I think that's a correct description. A lot of what is problematic and wrong in Greece is not just in the field of economics. In fact, you can argue that economic outcomes are the symptoms of an illness that is institutional. And this is not a new thing. For a very long time, observers have noticed how things in Greece in terms of institutional quality were not where they should be. Christopher Woodhouse was a very close observer of Greece. He came to Greece during the German occupation of the country as a member of the Special Operations Executive to organize sabotage action and guerrilla war. And so he wrote a book in 1948 describing his experiences, in which he starts by saying there have been Greek statesmen, but no Greek state. Behind and beneath them, there was no state. So that's a very common observation that you find throughout Greece's history, the fact that institutions in Greece tend to be hollow, at worst, of bad quality at best. And in fact, if you measure the relationship between the quality of institutions on the one hand and the income, which proxies for the level of development, what you find is that, in fact, Greece has a level of income that's above the quality of its institutions. That is, its institutions lag. They're not, and this is actually taking into account the GDP per capita in 2015, so after a very big depression. So if you were to measure both before, you would find an even more pronounced difference. So that, in a sense, I think is a correct diagnosis. But it leaves a number of open questions. First of all, there's a lack of precision about how to measure institutions and their quality. This particular indicator is based on a composite of various indicators, which I'm going to discuss later on. And also the other problem, which is more important, is if you look at the description of Greece's problems throughout time, you'll find, in fact, the same diagnosis over time. Institutions are bad. So there is a sense, very often, in what you read about that, that the quality of institutions remains the same, remains constant over time. And that cannot be the case. That cannot be true. And that leaves a number, also, of questions that have not been answered or addressed, I think, properly. First of all, of course, there's a very big question in political science, which is where do good institutions come from? How do you create good institutions? How do you avoid bad institutions? How do bad institutions persist over time? How do they persist? And do they persist over time? And we're going to see that that's a bit more of an open-ended question. So the popular answer to the source of bad institutions is that it has to do with foreign intervention. The fact that Greece never had really the ability to dictate the terms of its own governance. And there's a tremendous amount of consensus on that. You can find it in Anglo-Saxon journalistic accounts of the crisis, the best and most entertaining of which is Michael Lewis' account of the Greek crisis in Boomerang, in which he describes a lot of the distortions and pathologies of Greece in light of those bad institutions. But you can find it in, I would say, the high-quality scholarship by historians and sociologists throughout Greece. People like Nikos Bouzelis or Konstantinos Skalas, or even before them, Nikos Voronos. The standard argument is that foreign intervention has been the source of many problems in Greece, including its failure to perform according to its abilities. And in fact, a lot of it was very much influenced by the dependency school, the semi-periphery school that was very fashionable in the 1970s. But you find it very much in popular culture in Greece. For those of you who follow these things, this was one of the most successful overtime pieces, theater plays. The Great Circus is the title, which was written by one of the best Greek playwrights and writers in general, Theakos Kampanelis, and put in music. I think it was first performed in Athens in 1973, and I saw it in the 1980s. It's really remarkable, very high quality play that depicts Greek history as a shadow theater in which the puppeteers are foreigners who use Greece to further their own interests. So, and that is part of a very widespread kind of perception that, as I said, foreign powers, by intervening in Greece, perpetuate a number of structural problems. But you find the same argument in very, very different quarters as well. And I'm going to focus very much my remarks today on this paper by Carmen Reinhardt and Christopher Trebesh, published in 2015, which in a sense is an interpretation of Greece's economic trajectory, which follows very much from their very well-known work, the work by Reinhardt and Rogoff, about both the causes and the consequences of external debt. So what is the main points that those authors make in that paper? Well, the first point they make is that what is happening today in Greece is actually not novel. You can find a lot of parallels in the past. We find a remarkable similarity between the present and the past, and therefore the weight of history matters in that particular case. The second point they make is the presence of cycles of both external indebtedness on the one hand and default on the other hand. And in fact, they identify four distinct cycles of borrowing and default. And therefore, they say in very certain terms that debt and default is a perennial theme of Greek history. You can tell the story of Greece through those two factors. And they conclude, in fact, that the history of Greece is a narrative of debt, default, and external dependence, very much like a lot. Even though the mechanism is different, the logic is not very far away from the previous accounts. And they conclude, in fact, that's the last sentence of their paper, 200 years of evidence are presented to support the view that that chronic reliance on external capital has repeatedly led the country to ruin. Right? In more specific terms, they identify a sequence in those crises. So there's first a period of heavy borrowing, and that borrowing comes from abroad, from foreign creditors. They also add that an often overlooked peril of external borrowing is that it often arrives with heavy political baggage that may compromise the country's sovereignty. Right? So in a sense, that external indebtedness undermines sovereignty. And as repayment difficulties arise, foreign governments step in, help to repay the private creditors, and demand budget cuts and adjustment programs as a condition of official bailout loans. Sounds very much like Greece's present predicament applies to the previous three cycles, beginning with Greece's war of independence. So political interference from abroad mounts, and then a prolonged episode of debt overhang and financial autarky follows. The success of those interventions is often limited, and it's the most costly legacy of external debt is the loss of political control, the loss of sovereignty. So, in short, the argument they make is that you can identify a logic of recurring cycles in Greek history, that those cycles are characterized by a boom, a bust, and a bailout, and the main cost is, of course, loss of sovereignty, which means, in fact, ruin, however you define it. There are no benefits to this. Let's criticize that. Let's try to deconstruct it and find how we can actually use it as a way to rethink the problem. I think a lot of the problems that characterize these arguments, especially the last one, but more generally, is the sense of Groundhog Day, eternal repetition. That, in a sense, Greece's story is a story of disasters that repeat themselves. And, in fact, Greece is set up for failure, always has been, and therefore the real puzzle, if there is one to explain, is when Greece is not in crisis, not when Greece is in crisis. And you can, in a sense, think of Greece as a Sisyphus, a country that sort of carries this enormous weight and has to, in a sense, restart every time. Those cycles do not produce anything. They set you back, and then you restart, and then they set you back again. So it's a Sisyphean story, the story of modern Greece, according to those authors. But there is an empirical snag, which is that if you look at the empirical record, it doesn't really correspond to that kind of tale, to the Sisyphean tale, for a very simple reason, because Greece's record has not been as disastrous as it would seem. And that can be corroborated by a look at standard indicators, not just of income and growth, but also human development, which generally place Greece in a very high level of development, the top 45 countries in the world. That gives you a sense of the evolution of Greece's GDP from 1960 compared to the red line, which is Italy. So Italy is generally considered not a case of ruins, even though people would criticize it for various reasons. If you look at Portugal, it has a very similar trajectory in terms of GDP per capita. And then if you look at the set of other countries that Greece never gets compared to, but should, Turkey, Romania, and Egypt, you see that there has been an over time a very substantial difference in the level of economic growth and development. And the same is true if you turn to consumption per capita. Even with the loss that the crisis has caused, you can see, and the problems that exist in Greece are very real, you can see that Greece still performs quite well when it comes to consumption. So that doesn't look very much like ruin to me. On the other hand, both the diagnosis of bad institutions and of economic busts is real, and therefore we have to reframe the question. That is, if the failures are real, if the diagnosis of bad institutions is correct, if the cycles of overborrowing and then of default exist, how can we reconcile this very mixed record with the actual performance of the country? What explains that contradiction? How can we make those two stories fit together, which I think would get us to a story of Greek political and economic development that's closer to reality? So that's the challenge. If we want to move the critique a little bit further, we have to move away from just economic development and ask also the question, what about institutional reform? Remember that the sort of Groundhog Day argument about bad institutions is that they always are bad. They always perform very poorly. But if you look more carefully at the history of modern Greece, what is often surprising is that there is a record of institutional innovation that is often, that can be characterized and described as quite pioneering. So the creation in the 19th century of a successful state and nation building project for all its problems. Greece has been a country in which a major land distribution program took place, a country which was able to resettle about 1 million refugees in the 1920s quite successfully, a country that was able to recover from a decade of occupation and civil war very fast, a country that has instituted very early parliamentary institutions that operated quite successfully and without any interruption. That always surprises people who think that Greece's history is a succession of military coups and dictatorships. The remarkable economic takeoff that follows the Greek Civil War between roughly the early 1950s and the mid-1970s, Greece performs as close as Japan in terms of economic takeoff. The seamless transition to democracy that takes place in 1974 and is, in a sense, the precursor to the so-called third wave of democracy, which modernizes Greece's political institutions. And then, of course, the fact that Greece manages to become a member of a very exclusive club of wealthy, advanced democracies. All of that, in a sense, differentiate Greece from a host of other countries that have similar problems, but not a similar record. So it is not the case that institutions do not change. It's not the case that institutions always fail. So that raises the question also, what is the appropriate comparison set for Greece? If we go back to Christopher Woodhouse and his statement, there have been Greek statesmen, but no Greek state behind and beneath them, there was no state. He adds, no state like England or France were states, right? So what you find very often in the vast literature of travelers in the 19th century and then journalists and other observers is the perception that Greece ought to perform very much like advanced Western democracies in Europe and elsewhere. But is that the right comparative framework? I would argue that that very often is an artifact of the symbolic power that ancient Greece has exercised over the imaginations of many observers. The fact that Greece, associated with its glorious civilization, often sets a standard that does not necessarily correspond with the actual, quote-unquote, objective features of Greece. If you think in different terms, if you think of Greece as the most successful post-Ottoman state, then I think we're much closer to understanding the real challenges that Greece had to face, in a sense, in quote-unquote, again, modernizing. The circumstances were very adverse, not just because of the various structural impediments that came with being associated with the Ottoman Empire, but also within the Ottoman Empire, Greece, as a geographic area, was always considered as one of the most backwards and poor areas of that empire. And this, therefore, assessment of success, I think, becomes even more impressive, if you want, when placed in that particular context. If you were to make a thought experiment and ask an observer in 1820 to tell you which area of the Ottoman Empire they believe is going to become the most successful place 200 years down the road, I would actually venture the guess that probably no one would have mentioned the geographic area that became the modern Greek state. So, again, we need to reconcile these two stories, the failures and the successes on the one hand, and the bad institutions with a relative good performance, especially when placed in the appropriate comparative setting. And so that's the alternative. Just to recap the model by Reinhardt and Trebesch, they argue that, in fact, every cycle is characterized by three key elements: the big external borrowing, the big bust, and then the big painful and ineffective bailout. Right? And so what I did in my book in 2015, I didn't know the paper at the time. I wrote the book in 2014, so we're thinking in parallel ways. I proposed a picture that adds two additional stages. That is, the bailouts are followed by rebounds, and the busts, in a sense, are the perhaps inevitable consequences of very big projects. So that's the story that I described in my book. Just to refresh your memory, I'm not going to go into too much of those details, but we can discuss them in the Q&A if you want. First of all, the formation of a modern Greek state was a project that few people thought would be successful. It was a pioneering project for its time, the first, in a sense, modern national project in the Balkans, leading to one of the first new independent states in the post-Napoleonic period, and one that, as I said, few people thought could be successful or had objective conditions for success. The second one is the period of the long 19th century, which is the attempt to create in effect is what we, in a sort of orientalizing way, we call an oriental place, in a sense, Western institutions, both state institutions and a sense of nation that corresponded to what Western nation were thinking, which prefigures a lot of what is going to happen in the broader area and in Europe. The third big project is growing Greece from what was a very limited geographic area, almost unsustainable for an independent state, to something that was more sustainable over long term. The fourth, which is not very well known, either outside or inside Greece, is the attempt during the interwar period to create modern institutions, such as the Agricultural Bank of Greece, that is going to subsidize agriculture, create, you know, an early form of developmentalism. Then in the post-war period, we have the big project of turning Greece into a modern country. It is very difficult for young people today, for example, in Greece, to recall that just two generations before them, people used to go barefoot and to grow up in houses in which they live together with their domestic animals, meaning not pets, but actually food-producing animals, their pigs, for example. Greece was fully electrified only in the 1970s, very, very recently, and that happened very fast. Then the period that follows the transition to democracy is a period of creation of modern political institutions, democratization, establishment of the rule of law, and getting away from authoritarian elements and political discrimination. And finally, the seventh big project was, in a sense, to give Greece a currency that was strong and stable. That is the Euro project, which has led to the present economic crisis. So all these projects are very important, and they remind us of the very critical aspects that economists, who do not know much about Greece and do not care much about politics, tend to forget, namely that the economic busts are not just measures that seek to address economic issues, but are part of a political project which can only be described as a project of political modernization, turning Greece into a country that was similar in its operation, if not its performance, as most developed countries of Western Europe. That was the objective. And of course, these big projects need a lot of funding, and funding was very forthcoming in a variety of ways. That is just to give you a sense of both the transfers that came to Greece after the Civil War and also after the transition to democracy. And but not every period has funding. The period between the 1960s and the 1980s is a period in which actually Greece was able to perform without these kinds of external assistance. The flip side of that, right, is that externally funded big projects of this kind of magnitude can also lead to very big economic busts. And often the path, not always, but often the path is through the creation of bad institutions. And the idea here is an idea that's very, very familiar to economists who study resource scarcity. That is, when you depend, in a sense, on easy money, when you find access to easy money, you don't have the incentive to create strong institutions. For example, to tax effectively, which is an indicator of good performance for state building. The big busts are all associated with the big projects. The Greek War of Independence was militarily defeated. In the 1880s and 90s, Greece's model of state building came to a halt. Greece was militarily defeated in a war with Turkey and also went bankrupt. It had to be to face the pain of an international receivership process, very similar in some respects to today's project. In the 1920s, the big dream of Greece expansion came to ruins in Asia Minor, in Turkey, leading to one of the first and most tragic processes of mass ethnic cleansing. In the 1940s, Greece experienced a series of crippling processes of occupation and civil war. And then the late 1960s, its natural process of political development that was supposed to follow its economic development was stopped by the last military coup in Europe, last successful military coup in Europe that established an authoritarian regime. Finally, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, Greece came very close to a default, which was averted only because of the decision that at that point of Greece to join the euro. And finally, the eurozone crisis that has immobilized Greece and has led to the painful recession of the last 7 to 8 years has been the bust associated with the great project of joining the eurozone. But there is a flip side to the flip side, and that is that those busts always lead to foreign bailouts. Why? Because the funding is external. This is what makes the Greek case quite unusual. And it's unlike most states that borrow externally. Greece has always borrowed externally. And very often, it's a bailout of Greece's private foreign creditors. But in a sense, the transformation of private debt into an official debt, as we would call it today, of the PSI leading to, in fact, the official sector becoming the main creditor for Greece, has important political implications, identified in the paper by Reinhardt and Trobisch, but with very long-term consequences which are not identified as well. So the bailouts are never just economic bailouts. They're always accompanied by programs of institutional reform and a very strong conditionality. So they represent an external push for a readjustment, not just of the level of income to the bad institutions, but also a reform of the bad institutions to a higher level. That was the case, of course, and I think it's the most emblematic case. Very often when people describe the borrowing that made the Greek War of Independence sustainable in the middle term, they point out to how corrupt and ineffective that process was. A lot of the money that was lent by the City of London was actually lost to various brokers and intermediaries. It never really reached its intended recipients. But as a result of that, the Greek problem became a British problem. And in a sense, creating an independent Greek state was a solution for making sure that those debts would be repaid. So it was a way to internationalize the Greek War of Independence and make it eventually reach a successful outcome. Very much the same is true about the big bankruptcy of the late 19th century. There are very nice studies that show how the institutional reforms that followed the very painful adjustments were a precondition for Greece's ability to fight successfully in the Balkan Wars and double its territory. In fact, the field of the military itself is a very nice area to study these kinds of changes. If you read descriptions of Greece's defeat in the war of 1897 against Turkey, you have a description of the Greek military that very much resembles a bunch of clowns. The army disintegrates. People buy their way out of their military service. If you see a description of the same military in the 1910s, in the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 13, you find a very different military. So this is an example of institutional transformation that's quite successful. Something that not many people know is that in the interwar period, the League of Nations made it one of its big projects, and actually one of its most successful projects, to help resettle the million of refugees who came to Greece. And for those of you who study refugee politics, you probably know that it's one of the most challenging things to do. Very often, refugees remain refugees for a very long time. A very controversial, but I think very important aspect is the fact that Greece, in a sense, was experiencing a civil war at the beginning of the Cold War, was essential for the formulation, not just of the Truman Doctrine, but also the fact that Greece became the recipient of a very important financial windfall that helped it achieve the so-called Greek economic miracle of the post-war period. The transition to democracy, there is a very nice book by someone you know well, Irini Karamouzis, that shows how, to a great extent, accepting the Greek membership to the European Union before Portugal and Spain was very much conditioned, not just by the perception that Greece was a special case because of its history, but also as a way to reinforce its political institutions in the aftermath of the transition to democracy. And in the 90s, the surprising, return of economic growth to Greece, to some extent, was the result of the prospects associated with Euro membership and the conditionality that was associated with the process itself. And finally, it would be possible to argue, even though we're still the outcome is still not clear, that the massive bailout that followed the big crisis of 2010 is, in a sense, pushing Greece, kicking and screaming, not always effectively, but pushing in the direction of institutional reform as well as fiscal adjustments. So the bailouts, of course, cause loss of sovereignty. It's a tautology, in fact, to point that out. And they're, of course, very humiliating. Nobody wants to be bailed out. And finally, they have a distorting effect on institutions. They prevent institutions from developing endogenously, so to speak, domestically, and create conditions in which, very much like countries that have natural resources, develop institutions that are not really very good. However, we need to balance the loss of sovereignty versus the benefits of those foreign interventions, which is not something that many people do and not something that would be a popular argument to articulate. And I would argue that the bailouts historically have mitigated the effects of the busts. They have induced pain, but they have also induced the necessary discipline to readjust both the economy but also the policy, in a sense. And they have, as I mentioned, spurred an often quite successful process of institutional reform. So we have to also think about the counterfactual, what would be the alternative without bailout. And in most cases, I think one can make, on the basis of comparative evidence, the case that the absence of bailouts would have produced worse outcomes. And in fact, to go back to the initial graph that I showed you from a study that was done in Greece, if you look at the three most important components of the composite index of institutional quality, charted against the 2015 GDP per capita in Greece, And this has to do with public, the performance of the civil service, its ability to regulate, and I think the rule of law, which all of which are very problematic in Greece. But you find that when you look at those individual components, they actually correspond to the present level of GDP per capita in Greece. So there has been, in a sense, an adjustment. The income has gone down, and the institutional quality has gone up, with all its problems and questions. So let me try to wrap all this up so that we can have a discussion. What does this all add up? It is possible to start thinking about a stylized story of Greek development that departs from the standard theories. And so what would be the story? The story would be that you have incipient, very, very weak domestic modernizer coalitions that initiate very ambitious, very big modernization projects. They're very weak because the society in which they're operating is not a modern society, to use this kind of very simple, but I think, stark terms. What these elites do is, in a sense, to exploit a variety of factors such as the geopolitical situation of Greece, its symbolic capital, the ancient Greek legacy as a symbolic capital, to access international funds, so they are able to borrow internationally in a way that wouldn't have been possible otherwise, in order to finance their big projects. And I would argue that in most cases, it is this financing that makes both economically but also politically possible the development of those very big state building projects and the institutional expansion of the Greek state. However, it also, this windfall creates economic bubbles and also distorts institutional development. It undermines those very institutions that are created at the time. And as a result, it's followed by a bust, but the bust is followed by a bailout because of the foreign dimension. Income goes down, but then you also have, historically, you've had an institutional catch-up during that period. And then you repeat seven times. We don't know about the eight. So the takeaway here is that Greece, the Greek story, is a peculiar path to political and economic development because it's so much dependent on foreign borrowing. You can, in a sense, think of that borrowing as a way to subsidize a project of modernization that otherwise would have been impossible. And then the question to ask is, you know, bad institutions are bad, of course, but perhaps, you know, they've been historically good enough to achieve what has been achieved in Greece. And perhaps, you know, if we think about the objective conditions, expecting Greece to become, say, like Switzerland wouldn't be the obvious kind of comparison. But if you think about Greece as a counterfactual to Egypt, then you can argue that those institutions perhaps are good enough for what they achieve. You can give the story a negative spin, very much like all the authors that I cited. That is, it's a case of parasitic modernization and foreign dependence, right? Or you can give it a positive spin, a sort of fast track off the charts, effectively post-colonial modernization. Whereas what the story of Greece is a story, the story of the post-colonial world, much earlier, in the 1830s instead of the 1950s. And you can think of it as a device to achieve otherwise goals that would otherwise be out of reach. It's a sort of modernization by the bootstraps. And think about Latin America and the Balkans, as I said, as counterfactuals. Does this story apply to the current crisis? It would seem. There are many analogies, many similarities, that I'm not willing to project into the future, the past, because that would be a mistake. The questions that emerge from that story is, what's the best theoretical analogy? I don't think that it's good to think about the resource curse analogy. Because the difference here is that, in a sense, the country itself, Greece, is able to create its resource, as opposed to just stumble upon it. It's not just oil has been discovered, and then you can get the benefits of it. Second question, what explains the endurance? I don't think it's a story of past dependence. I don't think that the previous crisis, in a sense, prepared the next one, so the previous cycles are preconditions of the next ones. I rather tend to think, but I will have to do more research on it, that there is a sort of common structural underlying factor. Mostly, I think, a combination of Greece's strategic position that makes it very useful at critical times, and of course, the great power of its symbolic capital, the ability to claim the ancient Greek legacy that makes Greece a special case very often. But I also think there is a factor that tends to be overlooked, and this is the nature and type of the Greek elites. Because of its diasporic character, because of its, in a sense, tendency to be an extrovert kind of nation, precisely because it was very poor in terms of domestic resources, Greece was always able to produce cosmopolitan elites with very close presence and contacts outside Greece, and also the kind of outside ambition that goes with it. And I think the ability of those elites, in a sense, to manipulate the international system in order to both envision and design these very big outsized projects, and then to manage somehow to make do with the bailouts, I think helps us understand this kind of very... That is why I use the term punctuated equilibrium, because even though it's a series of failures, eventually it has a sort of progression to higher values. It is not just a Sisyphean tale. It's if you imagine Sisyphus sort of going, you know, getting knocked down, but then moving up every time, so that at the end of the seventh cycle, he's not just down, he's down, but at a much higher level. So that's the story that I think needs to be told, and of course needs to be studied more carefully. And it's a story that, in a sense, marries political and economic variables together. And that is, I think, one of the big blind spots of many analyses of the Greek case. So I'll stop here, and we can have a discussion.
Thank you very, very much for that. You've listed at least five questions of your own here, but I'm sure that the audience would like to ask questions of their own. So I'm not going to abuse my position here. I've got a bunch of questions I want to ask you, but maybe I'll save them for later. Please, over to you. Who would like to ask a question? Please, could you identify yourself for Professor Kalidis's benefit?
Hi, my name is Agnes Agello. I'm a PhD student in the European Institute. It's not clear to me from your model, how do you explain the directionality of policy change in the system, in the sense that you told us that you assume that domestic agents, Greek elites, are some kind of cosmopolitan, you know, outward looking. At the same time, you told us that there's some kind of weak institutions that are perpetuated after its external, essentially, incentive to modernize. So it's not clear to me, you know, how do you define the perpetuation of weak institutions while you have this type of elites and this type of other Spanish frameworks?
Yes. Well, in a sense, you can argue that the outsized role of elites is an indicator of bad institutions. That the ability of particular individuals or group of individuals to...
Alex, switch it off.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So the outsized role of the vision of specific individuals or of group of individuals is more in place under conditions in which established institutions do not operate well, and the coalition, if you want, which is not a proper term because it's not a formal process, it's more of an informal process of this kind of visionaries in Greece. Mm-hmm. With international processes Which is, I think, reflected in the fact that, as Mark Mazower has pointed out, a lot of the processes on which those visionary elites embark the country tend to be pioneering for its times. They tend to be in advance of it, precisely because it so happens, I think, that those elites are very much informed by global trends before they try to implement them in their own country, which lags behind. I think that is what gives the process its direction. I think there is nothing to assume that the process is going to be successful overall. And certainly, one can argue that those people, in a sense, launch a process without really having thought very carefully of the way it's going to unfold. But certainly, they do things that work in that direction. So to give you the example from the Greek War of Independence, the two things that internationalized the Greek War of Independence in the 1820s was the first one was to, in a sense, frame it not as a local revolt against the Ottoman Empire, which was the way in which most of the revolts up to that time were framed, but as an expression of the trends of the Enlightenment and the rise and the spread of liberal ideas, which mobilized a lot of liberal intellectuals across Europe. And again, to give you an example of such a cosmopolitan person is the figure of Adamantios Korais, a guy who is ensconced in Paris, never, goes to Greece, somebody who corresponds with Jefferson and who has partakes in those ideas very much. The second decision is the decision to get those loans from the City of London, which in a sense, as I said, makes the Greek problem part of the British agenda. So you can imagine alternatives in which those processes fail and do not result in anything. In that case, they work. So that's, I think, what drives the process in that particular direction. But again, I wouldn't call my story a theory or a model because there are so many areas that need to be studied and investigated properly. It's just my way to making sense of this fundamental contradiction between those, the combination of failures and successes, and also a reaction against what may be described as a very heavily economistic reading of Greek history, both by Greek sociologists and historians, but also by economists.
Hi, my name is Andreas Kupas. I'd like to start with a comment about the first loan that more than 80% never actually reached Greece. But what is more interesting, it was the first type of securitization, perhaps in the world. It was securitized by the future free lands. So it was a sort of a mission by those people who gave the money to grab the land for themselves. But my question is the following. You described very well the big busts and the elites and the Project Greece. But it seems to me that all of these projects, as you probably mentioned earlier on, were far and above what the Greek people could actually stand or understand or sometimes want. And this is actually the main reason why we had the busts. It was not the boom and the bust. It was the fact that there was a huge disparity between what these projects wanted and what the Greek people were able to sustain or to deliver. And we can see that now that the clientele system in Greece won finally in 2015. After all this upheaval of everything, the famous Pelagiakos just won a decisive victory, and I don't think we're going to see another battle for another 50 years. So,
well, I cannot talk about the future. certainly, I don't think that the outcome is has been reached. I think everything is still in play. But to talk, talking about the past, I think the example of the securitization of the loan against, Greece's status as an independent country, I think that's a move of genius. And again, the question is, what do you compare that to? If you compare it to the perfect outcome, which was Greece achieving independence without any strings attached, obviously it's not a good outcome. But if you compare it to an outcome in which Greece is not independent, the war, the revolution, as it was called, gets repressed, then I think it's not a bad outcome. So it all depends on whether you see the glass half empty or half full. So I think that's a very important aspect when we're thinking about Greece. And there's always a tendency to assume that the counterfactual for Greece is something that's very, very perfect. I remember giving a talk in Chicago, and somebody asking me, well, you know, Greece became independent, but it was nothing compared to the empire of Alexander the Great. That is the standard, and that is the comparison, yes. And absolutely, the objective conditions are not there. This is what makes those visions both extremely, you could say, risky and even, you could argue, dangerous, but at the same time, extremely bold as well. And, you know, again, you have to balance the benefits and the negatives of all this. I would argue even that talking about the Greek War of Independence, you know, who are the Greek people? I mean, if you think about the peasants on the ground, a lot of them don't have that perception. The fact that they become the Greek people is an outcome of that vision. So it's really, if you think about it in those terms, it's remarkable what was achieved at the time. And we tend to minimize that remarkable achievement because we, I think, very often set standards that are very unrealistic.
I'm also a sexual culture. Thank you very much, Patrick. And what I would like to ask you is whether you could go a little bit further in your institutional discussion and just tell us a bit more how do you see the particular institutions? I mean, which are the ones that you're talking about? And are they also part of the cycles? Is there a problem with adopting ambitious institutions and then at the level of implementation? They are, you know, more performing as well as they've intended. I mean, what kind of institutional explanation do we have there? And do you include at all in your analysis the cultural element? Because it seems to me that a lot of that kind of cycle, there is a lot of culture there that impedes the thing to kind of jump in there.
So you want me to talk about the role of institutions and culture in history?
You, 30 seconds. You can dump the cultural, but the institutional for me is not.
When we speak about institutions, usually, and that is one of the complicating factors, is we bundle together a lot of different dimensions. But generally, the idea is things like the rule of law, which implies the ability of the judiciary to perform in a sort of objective, impartial, and effective way. It includes the performance of the public administration, which means translating plans into actual actions. It implies things like public education, the provision of public goods, and also implies things like the quality of governance. So the question about clientelism is something that that goes into that area as well. And if I were able to find good indicators of the performance of those institutions over time, which is very difficult to do, but perhaps not impossible, I suspect that we would find a lot of variation over time. I would suspect, for example, that the quality of public administration varies, that there were points in which it was performing much better than other times. And so we would then need to explain that type of variation. Why is the quality of performance of public administration going down or up? I don't think that describing those institutions as constantly bad at the same level is very useful or very realistic. So that would be, I think, an interesting project of economic history and comparative analysis. But for example, if you look at the quality of parliamentary rule, say, in the period between the 1870s and the 1910s on the one hand, and then the 1910s and the 1940s on the other hand, the former period you find is one in which parliamentary institutions perform much better than the later period. So these would be the kinds of questions to ask. And there is quite a lot of feedback loop. Whenever these kinds of processes happen, they affect other parts of society. In terms of culture, I think one way to think about it is as a sort of collective response to failures and successes. A lot of people have described Greece as a low-trust society, and in fact, there is a lot of data to support this idea that there is low trust, and as a result of low trust,
you get poor quality, say, of the, you know, of rule of law, because you have too many laws, too many rules, as a way to squash this law trust, which creates inefficiencies. So you can see how, in effect, those two things are associated, implicated into each other. But at the same time, you can also see how very small interventions, in a sense, completely neutralize these supposedly very strong cultural reflexes. My favorite example in that respect is the comparison of underground and above ground behavior of Greeks in Athens. For some reason, underground they behave well, above ground they behave less well. For example, they don't smoke underground in the metro. They don't litter. Why? Because you have the right institutional setup. So if you can find the right institutional setup to neutralize supposedly unreformable cultural characteristics, that tells me that culture is not the kind of strong constraint that we often make to be. And very often, to be quite frank, I think the description of a sort of cultural constraint is a very convenient alibi by politicians and lobbies that do not really want to implement any real change.
I want to discuss a bit more maybe the theory, and because I'm pretty sure this is a refreshing story, which I mean, certainly use for my students, you know, to update them a bit, especially in Greece. But isn't that another path dependency story that you're giving us, just a bit more positive? Or this is what I could see, and you just put two different structural factors, geostrategic and symbolic, two different domestic factors, or is it something different here? Are you bringing in the agent more in? Because you talked about projects, so are you saying that these were really projects and not historical moments or coincidences or accidents?
Well, there's certainly, again, it's not a model because there are many things that are very difficult to model, for example, timing, good timing, or the sequence of decisions, things of that sort that are not easy to anticipate for, you know, the agents themselves. But I would say it's not a path-dependent story because there is no necessary precondition, say, for the second cycle to be predicated on the dynamic of the first cycle. And my sense, and again, that's my reading of the historical record, is very often there's a lot of forgetting. It seems that in every cycle, people rediscover new things and then realize similarities with the past, but they do not necessarily remember those. So I don't see how the process is really predicated on a starting point. It's more like a sort of repetition of processes that have similar characteristics and also different ones. I mean, I emphasize now the similarity because I want to give the contrasting element to the previous kind of theories, but if you were to study them, you would find very interesting divergences. But then I would also encourage people like you who study the performance of the public sector, if I remember correctly, to delve into these kinds of questions and correct this understanding that, in a sense, these institutions are unchangeable. In fact, just to give you a very quick example, I would argue that a lot of the literature on public administration in Greece during the period of 2000 and perhaps even a little bit before emphasized very much the modernization of public administration. So it was a very big surprise to find that when the crisis hit, that Greek public administration had such difficulty performing. So it's a very interesting kind of contrast. A lot of the arguments about the Europeanization of Greece emphasize the modernization of its political institutions, when in fact what was happening was their erosion. So it would be an interesting question to ask why this contradiction.
Okay, I've got at least three people, so we'll take them together.
We've got plenty of time, so the gentleman at the back first, and then we'll go this way.
Thank you very much. My name is Stephanos. First of all, thank you very much.
Could you speak up a bit?
Yeah, sure. The talk was very informative. Thank you very much for that. Just a question. I found it interesting the positive twist to the Greek story, and I can sort of relate to it to a certain extent. One could also, however, turn it the other way and say, okay, for the first 100 years, fair enough, great story against all odds. but maybe for the last, you know, half a century, maybe it's not actually punching above its weight. You know, it found itself in the right side of history at the Second World War. You had a few potentially lucky breaks as well, some elites making the right calls, etc., etc. So wouldn't one be able to argue that, you know, despite all of that, and managing to enter the very exclusive club, you know, we still found ourselves, you know, in a bit of a hybrid situation, unable to sort of either align ourselves with Western Europe, or, you know, still a Balkan state, or et cetera, et cetera. And so the second part of the question, would you, you know, lend any credibility to the narrative that, you know, Ottoman Empire, not having gone through a Renaissance, et cetera, has that any credibility as to why we're here, you know, after all these years?
I think the story of the Ottoman Empire is the standard story of post-colonial states. We have to create new institutions from scratch, institutions that are not organically developed through their historical development, but have to be imported from the outside. As you know, in the case of Greece, those institutions were initially created by barbarian state builders, which are among the most maligned ones in Greek history. The period of the barbarian regency is known as the barbarian occupation, right? But in fact, the work they did was, I think, fundamental. And you know, understanding, for example, legal development in Greece has to take into account those elements. So it's always an incredibly challenging process, a process fraught with all kinds of political, you know, cultural and other and social kinds of problems. So it's not easy to achieve. And I think Greece started early on that process and has achieved quite a lot in that respect. So I wouldn't minimize the achievements. I wouldn't argue that everything that has been achieved is artificial, fake, and doesn't really have any base in reality, as, you know, some people have the tendency to do. In terms of your first question, you know, of course, luck is part of that story. You need that, you know, for things to work out. But again, finding yourself on the right side of history, again, is not something that happens on its own. It has to be prepared, worked out, fought for. So there are a number of dimensions on which, of course, you don't have the capacity to reach an optimal outcome without that, you know, outside push. But, you know, when I talk with my Balkan history colleagues, people like Ivo Banac, for example, the thing that they tell me is how they see Greece, not just as extremely lucky, but as the country that always has managed to pull the foreigners in, when in fact their countries had always been forgotten and abandoned by the West. I mean, that is their big sort of story. Why did you forget about us? And how lucky you are, they tell me, that your country was gone. But I think it's not just a matter of remembering and forgetting independently of other factors. It has to be, in a sense, you know, the process has to be prepared, organized, thought out, and perhaps, you know, that's an element that works.
But this is perhaps where your cultural symbolism comes as well, because whatever the historical sequence is,
yes,
Greece always belongs to the West. In a sense, it defines the West. So it's quite
it's
end up on the right side of history, whereby the Croats and the Bosnians and the Serbs.
It's a powerful symbolic capital, but I think it's exactly just that. And again, to go back to the book by Irene Karamuzi about the accession of Greece in the EEC, that was an argument that was made a lot by people like, you know, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, the French president, and others. But as she argues, and I think she shows quite convincingly, it was an afterthought. Usually ancient Greece is what is being pulled out to justify a decision, but it was not necessarily what led to the decision, right? So that's an important aspect to keep in mind. It's something that justifies a rhetorical device that has true significance, but I'm not sure it's really what drives the process.
Okay, we'll take a few questions together now. The gentleman at the back, then the lady over here, then the lady over here.
My name is Yanis Kitromilidis, and I'm a retired academic economist. But perhaps we can go back to the slightly economic scenario of the Groundhog Day. You seem to suggest that 2010 was another Groundhog Day example. You don't kind of elaborate that first there was no default in 2010. We're still, Greece owes 300 billion and is still obliged to meet its commitments every 6 months. In July there is a another payment we made. And secondly, the bailout perhaps wasn't a bailout of Greece, but a bailout of a malfunctioning monetary union. You don't seem to, in both in the book and in what we heard today, to incorporate this. Is what is your reaction? So
let's take your questions off, please.
Hi, my name is Ioana Buluta. I'm an academic in management. And I thank you very much, first of all, for the interesting critique of modern Greece. I'm particularly interested in institutions and what you said about institutions. We hear all the time that institutions are stable or institutions are really bad in Greece. And I really liked your critique that maybe they are good enough. However, you implied that after the bust and every big project and bust, there is an improvement. So it's not a Sisyphus story, but there should be some sort of improvement in the institutional quality. Taking your theory to the current crisis, I noticed recently that the institutional quality in Greece is going down. For example, take the media, take the rule of law. I have seen many examples that do not indicate to me that there is this improvement. So could you please give us some examples of this institutional quality that you see, if you see something yet? Thank you.
My name is Grace Alopinaco. I'm a research associate at UCL. I would like to ask you about the Greek political elites. What has been the role, do you think, of the internal political dynamics? For example, have they facilitated the process during the cycle? And I would like your opinion about the last crisis, especially because you mentioned the modernization of politics and what
happened
during this
what has been the
main impact of that?
Sure, so all of them are very broad questions and therefore difficult to answer. So starting the first one, there hasn't been a formal default, but obviously Greece is unable to borrow. There has been a tremendous haircut, in fact, the biggest haircut ever, and by a huge difference, you should not underestimate that. And of course, the logic of the bailouts is not the logic of philanthropy. It's not that people realize that Greece made a mistake and decide to help them out of their own will. To give you the example of the first bailout, it's always, in a sense, a bailout of private creditors. And that's why the debt becomes official. But I think the externality of that process has the kinds of positive elements that I mentioned. In the present situation, and we can have a very long discussion, there are people in the room who are much more experts on that than I am, but for example, if you think about the debt, as a flow rather than a stock, if you think about interest rates and issues of that sort, there are elements of the debt that give it a dimension that perhaps is very often missed by market economists. And very much, again, the fact that it's an official debt makes it a very different kind of animal to begin with. And eventually, it gives it a political dimension, which is going to eventually lead to political solutions. I think that's a likely outcome in the future. Very good question about institutional change. Institutions are notoriously difficult to reform, and it's a process that takes a very long time. And usually what people who study institutions tell you is that the best time to reform institutions is when economic times are good, because then you can, in a sense, bribe the opposition to those reforms. It's very difficult to reform institutions at times in which the economy is tanking. Nevertheless, and this is a question that is very early to answer it. There have been a lot of institutional intervention in Greece. The result is very mixed, and we don't really have definitive studies of that process. We have some. The OECD has issued a number of midterm reports, and as I said, the picture is mixed. There are institutional reforms that didn't really. Were not really implemented. There were reforms that were implemented but did not produce the expected outcome. For for a variety of reasons. Either they were poorly thought or designed, or the fact that the economy was not working well affected their effect, their impact. But also there have been, I think, institutional reforms that have produced an effect. From, you know, I was discussing at some point with someone who was in charge of changing the ways in which the procurement of pharmaceuticals by the Greek health system operates, and she was telling me that, you know, lots of changes happened that had an effect of really reducing the cost of that. And there are a number of those very technical, not very visible, and not really, you know, sort of producing immediate effects kinds of changes that have been implemented. The question is, are they going to produce results quickly enough? How are they going to interact with the reforms that fail? And of course, all of that happens within politics, which raises the third question. And I think, again, one of the aspects that especially foreign observers of the Greek crisis have tended to underestimate is the extent of feedback loops with politics. Part of the reason why the Greek program performed so badly was that it created political instability, which created uncertainty about the danger of Grexit, which undermined, in a sense, economic performance. So you have this complex interaction between economics and politics. It's not easy to assess political elites in general because there are internal differences between them. So it's very interesting how, for example, we assess today somebody like Harilaos Trikoupis, a politician of the 19th century. There's a very nice new biography that came out. And he was one of these big visionaries. He decided that Greece, for example, should have railroads. So he borrowed very heavily, built those railroads, and then Greece went bust. And he lost power and was succeeded by a clientelist politician that nobody remembers today. However, the investment that happened during his years is now assessed by historians as necessary for the kinds of changes that took place later on. Likewise, I think we tend to very much describe everything that happened during the Greece's accession into the Eurozone as uniformly negative, as corruption or as bubble or as consumption. But a lot of investments also took place, and I think one of the potentially, you know, very big upsides that we're likely to observe in the future is going to be the result of investment in road infrastructure, which means that Greece has become much easier, much more accessible than in the past, which in an economy that is based on, you know, the provision of services of all kinds is absolutely necessary. So I think, you know, there are those things that are very difficult to assess at a given moment in time. So that's how we should evaluate political elites. And if, you know, the case of Harilaos Trikoupis is an interesting example, is that he tends to be remembered today and assessed in a positive light, in spite of the fact that his decisions led to bankruptcy.
Okay, Stati, let's take one last round of questions, because I've got three or four people who want to ask them, and then we'll finish after that. Thalia and Thalia.
Okay. Hello, I'm Thalia Maliolou, Hellenic Observatory. I'd like to look to your approach, comparison in time, but that creates a question for me. What is happening with the interactions between an entity that we understand as Greece? Is it the same that it was in the 19th century when the national state was created and this whole movement of nationalism all over the world? And what is happening now with Europe, with globalization, the West changing and becoming maybe something very different from what it was also at the time?
So you want me to speak into the future and predict how the world is going to
go? Also,
okay, one question to ask to other people.
As a constellation, it's not just a
Alexi Chong from GMSC. Just a curious question. From your story, have you noticed any recurring patterns in the way institutions react during the boom and bust cycle? And I'll place the example of the judiciary that you mentioned. Because from my research, for example, I see that when the crisis erupts, for example, courts tend to be more
passive, and as a crisis deepens, they tend to be more active. So have you noticed from these cycles other such patterns?
Agios Isoyevos from King's College. I would like to ask, what exactly is the, what institutions exactly are you comparing across time? So if I understand, for example, the standard account of why Greece got better between 1897 and 1912 is that its army, the effectiveness of its army was improved. Yet now, you're measuring, you see, you mentioned roads or procurement of pharmaceuticals. Is there comparability, or are you just picking the most important institutions at any given point in time, or are you looking, for example, taxation throughout time? Or I'm wondering what exactly is that you're comparing over time.
Okay, let me start from the last question. Taxation is a very nice example of institutional reform. It is generally understood, and there is some very interesting research, that there is a very close link between the level of taxation and the demands of accountability. People will demand accountability from the political system when they are being taxed. And as we know, the Greeks were not really taxed properly. Now they're overtaxed, perhaps. But you know, one of the most progressive reforms, I think, that has happened in Greece is the introduction of effective property tax, which is both progressive and necessary for the creation of an effective state and also the demands of accountability. That would be, even though people hate it as a tax, I think it's a good example of that. Now, of course, institutions change over time. Even in the 1910s, it was not just the military that changed. In order for a military to be able to perform properly, it has to operate within a system of public administration that's better run. One of the things that's striking is the set of reforms that were articulated by Venizelos in 1910, which included all kinds of things from the creation of a much more impersonal bureaucracy through the introduction of the system of tenure, for example. And all of these things converge into results that can be measured in one area or another. I think I would argue that it is very difficult to think of an effective implementation of land reform after 1917 without these earlier reforms. So again, this, I'm not measuring things. This is a sort of very big picture story. But I'm sure that over time, if we decided to measure one dimension, say the performance of the courts, we would find fluctuations and a variation that would actually would call for an explanation. About the courts, I'm not sure. How institutions respond to the booms and the busts. One can possibly think of situations in which booms have very negative effects for some institutions and positive effects for other institutions, and vice versa. It's, you can formulate a hypothesis and try to see how those things work. I would argue that within even the field of, say, the provision of justice, that you would find differences in the performance of different judiciary bodies, even though it's a rather unified system. So why is it that some of them respond better to challenges than others, is a question to ask. And to the first question about the future of the world, I would just mention that if there is a striking similarity between this cycle and some of the previous ones, is the extent to which Greece's crisis managed to become global crisis, or to capture in its zeitgeist of the moment in a way that's remarkable, right? Now, what exactly is going to be that zeitgeist ex post? I do not know, because I live in the now. It could be a story about how, the civilization as we knew it ended, the European Union collapsed, everything came to an end, the West, no longer exists, and Greece, was at the forefront of that trend. Or it may be a story of the opposite outcome. It may be a story of how, that crisis provided incentives for, rethinking reorganization and, the strengthening of the foundations of that world. So who knows? We'll find out, perhaps.
Okay, so thank you. That's optimistic.
Very optimistic. We'll draw
a few solutions to that. Normally, at this point in time, we have this chair in this particular seminar,
makes an announcement about the seminar is going to take place in a fortnight, but this is the last seminar of the year, so there isn't a seminar in 2 weeks' time, so this is a very fitting way to end. I will keep you on tentacles, though, to say that we do have a major political figure speaking at the LSE on the 15th of May to be announced in the next couple of days, so we will see you back at the LSE before the summer. In the meantime, please join me in thanking Stanley very much for